On Point, hosted by Peter Van Aartrijk. Conversations with interesting and informative experts on technology, branding, culture, social media marketing, and other great topics.
Hello again, everybody. Peter Van Aartrijk, your host for On Point, brought to you by our good friends at Wells Media, which includes Carrier Management, Insurance Journal, and other fine publications. On Point is streaming on both Apple Podcasts and Spotify, so you can follow the show and get updates when we have a new episode. You can view both sites by clicking on either the Apple or Spotify button below the player at insurancejournal.tv. Our guest today is Alan Ferguson, who's the president of US Assure, which for 45 years has been the exclusive administrator for the Builders Risk Plan insured by Zurich. Alan, thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And for those who can safely surf, it's usassure.com. But Alan, I know this is an interesting coverage area, and I got my own personal connection with it. It's kind of an odd story, but I'll explain that later. But in the meantime, I think the listeners would like to know a little bit about you, your background, your career. Everybody's got a story. The industry is so interesting. So how did you get to where you're at today?
That's actually a great question. I've been with US Assure now for 31 years. And to be quite honest, I actually worked here about 5 years prior to joining full-time as a teenager. So I had a interesting inroad in the insurance business. My father was one of the original principals of then the Home Builders Insurance Program. And during the summertime in the college, I actually worked in our underwriting department in the builder's risk area. I worked a little bit in the finance area, did some accounts payable stuff, and was really given the chance to see the insurance industry from a different perspective than most teenagers. Most teenagers or people in their early 20s, their first experience with insurance is they turn 16 and they either argue with their parents about how much car insurance costs or they're unfortunate enough to have to pay it for themselves, which we all know is not the best experience at a young age. So I was able to learn more about the business and the people side of it by working. And then, you know, it was really a retail agent / wholesaler for then an all lines casualty product for home building contractors. So not only were they doing builder's risk, which was I was primarily involved in, we were also doing GL comp, auto, workers comp for those contractors. And when I finished college, I was given the opportunity to come in and interview with Tom Petway, who was my dad's business partner at the time, and went through a little back and forth with the two of them, as well as a guy by the name of Bob Casanova, who was really my first boss here, and I worked for him for probably 15, 17 years. Went through some corporate psychology stuff and really had to have a talk with myself on whether or not I wanted to be in a family business, truth be told. And at that time,
no kidding.
And at that time, people my age, I had a degree in finance. I wanted to be a stockbroker. I wanted to go rule the world of Wall Street. And I did interview with some banks, some investment banks, and quickly realized that to do that, I'd have to live in New York City. And I just had no desire to leave Jacksonville, Florida. And so really, I kind of fell into this opportunity by happenstance. And it ended up being probably the best decision I made, going forward. And the unique thing then is we had a closely aligned relationship with the Maryland Casualty Company back in the early 90s, and they were really the paper we used for all of our programs and products. And carriers and agencies and wholesalers back then were a little bit unique. Carriers really had a vested interest in the young people coming in the business. And they almost, I won't say they had agency schools, but they had unique training programs. So I started here in Jacksonville in February, and within about 10 days, I had a U-Haul trailer packed up, and I moved to Charlotte, North Carolina, and I spent 4 or 5 months working for the Maryland Casualty in the Charlotte field office. And the premise behind that was go learn the insurance business. So I sat at an underwriting desk, really worked as an underwriting assistant early on. Over time, kind of gradually learned more and more about the business. I went out on trips with risk engineers to see projects we were insuring. I went out on claims to see how the claim side of the business worked. I went and did audits with some auditors to see how the audit side of the business works. I really spent 4 months learning property and casualty insurance, which is crazy unique. We hire somebody today, we sit them right at a desk and throw the whole world at them. So I had the ability, to really learn that side of the business. And I spent about 4 months in the Charlotte field office working for the Maryland, and I came back to Jacksonville and spent a month working in our builder's risk department. Now as an underwriter, I was no longer, when I was a teenager, I was mostly sifting through the mail and batching stuff and preparing stuff for people to key in the system or to underwrite. But now this month, I was really learning the builder's risk side of the business. And at the same time, I was going through a pretty in-depth training program here in Jacksonville around sales and marketing, how we go to market, how we manage distributors. I took a couple courses on public speaking because that was going to become a large part of my job. So I actually went to a class, I'll never forget, in Atlanta called Speakeasy, where you basically are taught how to address a large crowd, how to handle media requests, all those types of things. At the end of that 1 month of Builder's Risk, probably another month or so of that training, I was sent back to a Maryland field office, and I went to, of all places, Parsippany, New Jersey, where I spent about 3 weeks in their field office because they had workflow issues. They were behind. They had staffing things. So I was kind of sent to kind of help catch them up, and I went from there to Buffalo, New York, for about 2 weeks as well. Fortunately, both these assignments are in the August-September timeframe, so it wasn't too brutally cold. And then after that, I came back to Jacksonville and was kind of tasked with following around these five people that were going to really be my mentor in this business. And what they were doing is they were what we call marketing vice presidents. They each handled a territory, let's say anywhere from 8 to 12 states, where they were responsible for recruiting independent agents, educating independent agents, motivating those agents to sell our products and programs. And they did this, you know, with a small staff here in Jacksonville, but really with a, you know, a suitcase and a slide projector. We would travel. Back then, that job, you probably traveled 26 to 28 weeks a year, and you would go into local cities in your territory, invite in all the agents that represent the program. We really went through a three-hour presentation on what is Builder's Risk Insurance, what is casualty insurance for contractors, why are we unique, why are we better. And I really did that the remainder part of my first year here in 1993. And then in 1994, I was given my first marketing territory. And to give you an idea of, you know, what it meant to be the new kid on the block, my territory, I lived in Jacksonville, Florida, as did everybody else here. My first territory was Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Montana, and Alaska, and Texas and Louisiana. So I was given parts of the country nobody else wanted, I believe.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
I'm sure they sat in a room and said, what can we do to punish him? So over time, through that, I did that role. I was in that role for roughly 7 years. So I traveled 25 to 30 weeks a year for 7 years. Fortunately, my territory did change, and I ultimately ended up getting a lot of this to the Mid-Atlantic and the Southeast. I always kept Texas, Louisiana, added New Mexico. I probably did a meeting in all but probably three states in the country. I don't think I ever did any in the Dakotas. I'm not sure I ever did one in Wyoming. But other than that, I'm pretty sure I had every state in the country, including Hawaii and including Alaska, to do those meetings. So it was a unique experience in my early 20s, and it was one that I, you know, look back on and think, God, how could I do that today, which I don't think I could. We still have that role here in Jacksonville. We have one person in that role, and she travels, you know, probably 25 weeks a year, and she loves it, and more power to her. I don't think I could do that anymore.
Yeah.
Coming out of that, after that 7 years, our organization and our relationship with Maryland was constantly evolving. We had added other products during that time period. We had begun to talk about operating a service center for those folks. And then the tail end of my marketing world or marketing role in 1997, we started looking at the internet. There was this new crazy thing out there, everybody called the internet. And a lot of companies had websites, but they were basically, for lack of a way to put it, it was almost like a billboard on the highway. It was just on your computer screen. A little bit of information about the company, but you could click to contact somebody, maybe get a call back. And we started looking at it. Was there a way we could leverage this thing called the internet to do business in a more effective manner? And so I was tasked with figuring that out. So we spent about 4 months working with then a few of the IT folks at the Maryland Casualty Company. They had a similar interest, and we came up with a concept or the idea that we could actually issue a builder's risk policy online. So we introduced a website in December of 1997, and the first week in December of that year, we issued our first policy over the internet. We're fairly certain we're probably the first PNC company to do that globally, if not at least in the U.S. And that really set our business on a different track. It really enabled us to take what typically before was a four-part carbon copy form that was like 8.5 by 14, that we would provide to the agent. They would put it in a typewriter and type the policy, type the underwriting questions on that, and they would rip top copy off, and that was the insurance declaration page. The second page would come to us with a check for the premium. third page would go to the bank or the mortgagee, and then the fourth page was the agent. So we took that process and we streamlined it to the point that back then it took almost about 7 or 8 minutes for an agent to go through the process because of bandwidth issues, the clunkiness of how the internet worked in the late 90s, but really kind of set us apart on a different trajectory. So as we began to do more stuff with Zurich, because of my involvement with that, we got to a point with then the Zurich after the Maryland was purchased by the Zurich, where we began being sought after by them to run a service center. So we've kind of, Zurich made the determination that, you know, prior to 1999, the folks in Jacksonville, they called us, or the home builder people, or the construction insurance services people, depending on the era. We were always the sales and marketing arm of Maryland Small Construction, which became mm-hmm. Zurich Small Construction. And then Zurich kind of went through this global change where they determined they wanted their folks to be the local market managing expert. They want to centralize the underwriting. So we literally, over a period of about a year, went through a process and a plan and about 18 months to convert the plan. The organizations changed responsibilities. So we transitioned all the sales and marketing efforts to 42 to 44 field offices around the country. And then we rolled in all the policy processing, administrative support, underwriting support into Jacksonville, Florida. And when we did that, you know, our staff went from about 120 people to well over 500. We became a call center. So at that point, because of what I had learned from doing the internet and implementing network strategies around here so that our employees could access the internet, I kind of transitioned out of the sales and marketing role into basically led our IT operation for about 3 or 4 years. So I went from wearing the sales and marketing hat to being the guy who designed the IVR systems, still did the website stuff, kind of built out all the network infrastructure, which was kind of a unique, not in my background experience. So there's a lot of learning on the go or on the fly, as you would say. And as we did that, we built that service center that was really now servicing not only our builder's risk book, which is really, you know, the core of why we're here today, but we were also doing all the Zurich small business processing, all the Zurich small construction processing, as well as a myriad of other unique programs that Zurich kind of pushed towards us because they couldn't create the efficiencies to make them work. Mm-hmm. And as we were running that call center, we realized that the builder's risk book was maybe losing a little bit of its specialization in the market. So the individual that prior to this transition maybe only did builder's insurance, you know, 5 days a week, and now all of a sudden we've got them in a call center environment where they're answering a question on builder's risk at 8 o'clock in the morning on Monday, and at 8:05 they're answering one on a small church, and by 9 o'clock they've talked to three different people about dry cleaners, and then around lunchtime we get another builder's risk question. And what we figured out is by not having that really that repetitive nature of builder's risk, builder's risk, builder's risk, we were losing our edge in the market. And we were getting, for the first time ever, comments, not complaints, but comments from, you know, key producers that, you know, you guys may have made a misstep here. You may not I realized what you've done to the builder's risk part. So as an organization, we sat back and determined we were going to pull builder's risk out of that service center and stand it up as its own P&L within the same organization. So that time I transitioned from running the IT department back to running that builder's risk P&L. And this is probably early 2002, 2003 timeframe. And this is at the same time period where we introduced a different business model where not only were we selling builder's risk to agents that had a Zurich contract, we stood up another entity we called buildersrisk.com where we were selling builder's risk business through any independent agent in the country that we deemed to be a professional agent. So what we determined, because of the technology platform and because of the benefits of now having underwriting edits mixed in and really creating the first the first version of a black box, we didn't really have a huge concern over the source of that business. So it's very unique in that perspective. So that kind of set us on a different trajectory in the builder's risk world. You know, fast forward to, I'd say, around 2008, Zurich Small Business, or Zurich Globally, made the decision that they want to get out of the small business world. And so that book of business was sold to Farmers. It was a unique event for all of us here in Jacksonville. At this point in time, we have roughly 525 employees. We're processing over $1 billion of coverage for the Zurich folks. And then ultimately overnight, we get a phone call that says, we're going to take sell the renewal rights of the small business book to the farmers exchanges, and we're going to take this builder's risk program, which we love, we want to keep, we're going to transition that into ZERC programs. So at that point, our organization went through a pretty unique upheaval. So now the stuff that we spent 2 years rolling into Jacksonville, we had to roll out of Jacksonville into Grand Rapids, Michigan. There was a significant transfer of talent. They probably hired 25 to 30 of our employees. There were a couple hundred folks who in this process essentially lost their job on a go-forward basis. So it was a unique time around here. And not only were we at this point doing, you know, this servicing in the small business world, we were also administering and processing and servicing all of the direct bill business for all of ZERC in North America. We were responsible for all the agency contracting and appointing process for all ZERC agents in North America. So some of those services stayed in here for a short while. Our name at this point in the time is ZERC Insurance Services. And you know what we realized is these other collateral programs we picked up along the way, ZERC had no longer interest in writing lawyers, professional liability, motor truck cargo, commercial storage tank business. So we were now out engaging other carriers for the first time in my career to find a way to get capacity to keep some of these programs in place. And we were doing that in an environment where our brokerage name was ZERC Insurance Brokerage Services. So as you can imagine, if I go to ACE and say, I'd love to write commercial storage tank business with you, the name of my agency is ZERC Insurance Brokerage Services. The first thing they say is, are you part of ZERC? Or why doesn't ZERC want it? So we went through that transition. When we went to the .com model on the builder's risk side, we actually started a brokerage entity then called US Assure. And so we made the next choice in our, you know, lineage going forward to switch our name from ZERC Insurance Brokerage Services as well as ZERC Insurance Services, which is the holding company, to become US Assure Insurance Services of Florida. And once we made that transition, we were essentially out of the servicing business for all of ZERC. We had now transitioned out all the billing to a shared services operation they had. All the contracting and licensing was now out of here. And we were left really with the builder's risk plan, which at this point in time is, you know, extremely successful. It's largely responsible for the bulk of our revenue. We had probably, I'm going to say 16 or 17 other small programs that totaled up to be about $30 million in premium that we really could never generate the scale and the margins that we could on the builder's risk side. So we made a decision that at the time was a little bit controversial. We sat down and looked at that book of business and made the decision to pull the plug, so to speak.
Okay.
So we sold all those programs to another MGA in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on a renewal rights deal. And at that point, we became solely focused on builder's risk as an organization. So we really ratcheted up a level of specialization under that scenario. And really, since that time going forward, it's proved out to be the best decision we could have ever made.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a unique story.
Man, Alan, you'd be a history teacher if you ever lost your day job. Because, I mean, that's a lot of detail. I think I asked you one question. That might be a record, 15-minute answer. But it's really interesting stuff, and how what it says to me is how resilient, flexible, innovative you guys have been to respond to. You know, the corporate world can make, you know, especially on a global level, a company like ZERC, they're not the only ones. You know, they make decisions, they do things, there's M&A, and here you guys are. And I think that speaks to the model. I think it speaks to your focus ultimately in what you're doing with Builders Risk, and it's good stuff. But let me just ask you a couple of quick questions, rapid fire round, because you said a few things that I think are very intriguing. Was that guy's name really, his last name was Casanova?
Castronova.
Oh, darn. I thought I had a good story there. Okay. Yeah. Castronova. Okay. And the speakeasy training, I think, is really good. I don't know that particular company, but just the idea of you know, going and succumbing to speaker and media training, it's very humbling. Now, there's no doubt about it. But so many folks in the insurance industry could use that kind of training because I'm sure you picked up a few things that, you know, they use for the rest of your career, I would imagine, because that's really helpful.
We forced all of our people who are in that role to do that. And I think almost all of them to a person would tell you it was one of the most terrifying experiences.
Oh, it's terrifying.
They videotaped everything.
Yep. It is terrifying. Yeah, I mean, like giving speeches, the media is a whole nother level of anxiety, but giving, well, not insurance trade, you know, those guys are pretty respectful. But I mean, if you're going to be doing general media, it can be super anxiety driven. But, you know, speaking, it's basically, I learned over the years, 30%, you know, research, 30%, what's your presentation going to be if you're going to have some, you're going to show some things. And then, you know, the other 90%, to quote a phrase from Yogi Berra, is just practice. You know, you really have to work at it. You can't just assume you know everything. But the other thing you said was you traveled with your own slide projector. I think it's so funny because you had to bring your own stuff because A, you couldn't trust anyone else had anything, and B, that it would even work, you know? So you had to carry your own slide projector. And all those meetings with agents, I think more, not that you're an insurance carrier per se, but I think more insurance organizations need to spend time, real time, as you did with agents. And some do, maybe a lot do, but more should, especially people in middle management and above, because you learn so much when you meet face to face with these people and see what they're dealing with on the front lines. You know, I think that was good experience that you travel around doing that.
Yeah, that's awesome. And they really are. I mean, they're the conduit to the customer. And in our world, it's almost like we're a manufacturer's rep. We have this product, we do the underwriting, we cede the risk off to Zurich. But this agent and broker, that's who's dealing with the person who's paying the premium, who's having the losses, who, you know, is really the one that's concerned about the risk that's out there. So you learn a lot. And we still do distributor advisory council meetings today, where our senior leadership meets with 30 to 40 key distributors to go over, you know, trends in the market, things they see, what can we do to be better, what are our competitors doing. But the bulk of that meeting, if we spend 2 days together, we just did it recently in Nashville for 2 days, we were probably in meetings with that group of folks for a total of 6 hours over 2 days, and the rest of the time was really spent around social activity, team building, collaborative conversation. You know, what can we learn from you guys to make this business better? So it's really a unique way to approach the market. And, you know, mm-hmm. without the agent, our business doesn't exist.
Yeah, for sure. But speaking of agents, so quick story. I might be one of the only people in the U.S. or one of a handful, maybe, who has a certified insurance counselor degree designation from the National Alliance, CIC, who has never sold insurance, never been licensed. And I did it because I was an insurance reporter back in the day. And I remember there were certain classes, there were certain courses or sections of the training where the teachers would talk like a couple hours about builder's risk. And mobile equipment was another one, but builder's risk. And then over the years, because I've had it since 1990, I go to update classes. And without fail, every time they get into builder's risk, a bunch of agents would stand up in the middle of the class and run out of the room. And it's because they're like, oops, oh, I didn't, you know, we didn't buy the coverage. Oh, I didn't know that. You know, it was astonishing, really. And so what is it about that? Because that's one of those things that, you know, obviously a lot of agents know about it. I don't mean to say they all don't, but it's one of those, did you know that for, you know, residential and commercial properties and, you know, homeowners and, you know, building owners and agents, everybody's sort of, it's sort of a surprise for them, isn't it, sometimes?
Yes. Yeah. It's oftentimes the last thing that's thought about in the construction process. It's kind of interesting. And over time, there's even line items now in the AIA standard documents for, you know, residential construction. That there's a line item for builder's risk premium, but invariably folks miss it. They don't think about it. They're so consumed with the GL side of the house, the workers' comp side of the house, the bureaucratic part of getting that house out of the ground. So going through the loan process, going through the permitting process with the city, oftentimes at the very end, this job has finally been sold. We finally got the permits. We go to the closing and then the banker says, so do you have any builder's risk insurance? And people kind of look at each other with a blank stare, like that's not covered under my casualty policy, or I thought the homeowner purchased it. The homeowner says, I thought the builder was going to purchase it. So it is often overlooked, and it's probably the base or core component of coverage you need to ever even start building a structure if there's any sort of lien or mortgage on the property. it is kind of unique.
Yeah. So what is going on in, as you look out in the marketplace and not only Builders Risk, but just construction generally, what are some trends? What are you seeing in the marketplace? Any highlights? And also what you see coming down the pike?
So we're, I'd say the way I describe it, we're pretty bullish on the construction industry right now. I mean, I'm obviously biased. It's the world we live in. It's, you know, how I put food on the table. But ultimately, what we've seen is, you know, the residential construction industry, in our opinion, is kind of back. You know, 2006 to 2009 was a pretty rough time period for residential contractors. Most people call that the Great Recession. You know, you saw a period of time where single-family housing starts went from roughly 1.7 million a year. They dropped all the way down to 400,000 units a year. So during that time period, you basically saw a giant swath of residential contractors just disappear. They went out of business. They got other jobs. And unfortunately, when that happened, you saw a lot of the trades kind of disappear as well. And up until about 2018, 2019, you know, the home building market it underperformed. We just weren't producing enough homes, new homes, to keep up with household formation, population growth, population shifting, and all the things that were taking place out there. And really, from our perspective, and really the fourth quarter of 2019 is where we really saw residential construction come roaring back. Like, it was the best fourth quarter in the history of our company from a, you know, unit premium standpoint. We really saw that the looking forward, the interest rate market looked great. The demand was there. And then in March of 2020, we had this unique thing turn into a global pandemic occur. And we really saw a massive slowdown in new construction for, oddly enough, only about 60 to 90 days. So really what that meant is contractors and municipalities and banks, everybody kind of figured out a way to make it work. So it slowed things down. The typical job where you might have on a residential project on the rough end days, you're going to have an electrician, a plumber, and an HVAC guy all there on the job the same day. A lot of parts of the country, only one trade a day was allowed on the job because of COVID. So the HVAC guy would have to do his work, then the electrician would have to do his work, then the plumber would come 2 weeks later and do their work. And it really slowed our business down from a start to finish component of how we ensure projects. So now, because of the labor issues, because of supply chain issues, a lot of jobs that typically we would ensure that might take 6.5-7 months are now taking 14 to 16 months. So it kind of changed the landscape for all of construction. And that sucked a lot of labor out of new jobs because these guys, these trades are staying on some of these jobs that are taking longer. So you fast forward coming out of COVID, the virtual work environment, you saw a lot of shifting and remodeling and how we work, how we live. You saw people exiting large city centers out to suburban areas. And so really what we've seen coming out of COVID is we saw that dip for that 60 to 90 days. And then, you know, 20 into 2020, 21, 22, we saw single family housing start to kind of take off again. And really, if you look at the housing numbers on an annualized basis as of, you know, the end of February, we're over 1 million single family starts again on an annualized basis, which in our opinion, that's a healthy housing market. Anything over 1 million is a very healthy market. So we're pretty positive on what we see from a run-up standpoint. And that's with some pretty significant headwinds around mortgage rates, some headwinds around some bureaucracy stuff, you know, those types of things that all builders have to deal with. But from our perspective, you look at what's taking place as you're seeing new home sales were up in the month of February over last year by about 6%. That's a two-month increase for the first time since, I believe, the early 20s. You're starting to see the millennials, this cohort is now the largest population out there. They are now the age where household formation is a thing. We're starting to see inventory come back where maybe some of the baby boomers that sat tight coming out of COVID are now considering downsizing, so they're putting their houses on the market. They're looking for newer, smaller homes. So we're starting to see a churn now that to satisfy this demand that was really created by that lackluster performance of our own industry coming out of that Great Recession. And you could pick your economic expert, your economist. We follow a couple around here. But, you know, there are some projections that say there is a shortfall of housing in the U.S. that could be as many as 3 to 6 million units. So to us, that demand, the demand is transient. It's not always a single family home. Sometimes it's a condo. Sometimes it's assisted living. Sometimes it's an apartment. It could be a college dormitory. But ultimately, that demand for housing is there, and it's really not being satisfied. So we're pretty bullish on that. And then what we've experienced in our business, and as we've grown, kind of become our own little macroeconomic model almost, that as we see, you know, when you see housing expand out in the suburban areas, the first thing you see is, we call it convenience infrastructure. It's not infrastructure like you would think of when the government talks infrastructure about bridges, highways. We're talking about grocery stores, dry cleaners, gas stations, restaurants, schools, municipal buildings, safety buildings. We're starting to see this, where this residential sprawl has happened. Now all these services have to come in, and those services are at such a level, it's creating more sprawl. More people want to live out there, so it's driving the demand for more new houses. So it's kind of created this cause and effect scenario that we see really going into the probably the third quarter of this year. We think we'll have at least one downward shift in mortgage rates. We thought we would get it in March, but we didn't. We may even have two by the end of this year. And we really think that that's just going to amplify all these trends that are out there that are all overwhelmingly positive. The only real negative is that one little bit of a financial headwind or cost headwind, you know, that's really tied to a little bit to the hangover from inflation and a lot to those mortgage rates. So we do think we're going to overcome that this year, and we think it'll be pretty much wide open again.
Yeah, it's interesting the pent up demand that you're describing. You know, it's like a waterfall effect. If there's a catalyst like lower interest rates. You know, I also live in Florida, Alan, and you know, there's no state income tax. People love it down here, but insurance is off the charts. Property insurance, and also taxes are going up as well. Property taxes combined with the interest rates, it makes it harder for folks to afford stuff. But the other, you know, and I think the insurance industry was blamed for this. You know, the hard market, the pricing is putting a damper on economic growth as well. What do you see for the rest of 2024? Do you think, because it's been a very difficult market? We talk to agents all the time. You know, the number one concern they have is keeping their people. They're concerned about morale. They're on the phone all day long with angry people, you know, angry consumers and business owners with the prices they have to deliver, the price increases and such. So what's it been like in your marketplace, and do you have any sense of where it's headed?
That's a great question. And living in Florida, I feel the pain on the permanent property side as well, as far as homeowners insurance and how that goes. But I think ultimately, the industry as a whole has done fairly well, really, the last 3 years. There has been some significant cat activity. So there have been significant events, whether it be wildfire, hail, tornado, some flooding, few wind events here and there. But overall, you know, from a reinsurance standpoint, the reinsurers have had a pretty happy run the last couple of years. Those events have not necessarily been to the level where they're not piercing those reinsurance treaties that are out there for the large cat level. So what that means is that the primary layer of insurance countrywide now is kind of dealing with this thing they call secondary perils. So these are events that are unusually larger than normal, but they're not large enough to hit those events. So a couple months, weeks ago, we had some significant hail float through Dallas, Missouri, that part of the country, where creating certainly a frequency issue for these insurance carriers. So there's more and more smaller claims coming in that they're having to contend with. What's happening in the areas like Florida around the significant increase in homeowners insurance is really a market availability. A lot of it has to do with some much needed tort reform around notification or intent to sue insurance companies. The assignment of benefits is going away. I do think in Florida, we will see improvement on a go forward basis. The legacy carriers, you know, are going to struggle a little bit longer, but a new carrier coming in that kind of is starting over in a brand new world, right? So that is a little bit unique from that perspective. But I think ultimately, you know, insurance is really about capital, and it's a risk transfer mechanism. We like to say in our business that we're in a hard market. If you talk to someone who's a CEO of an insurance company, they'll say it's not a hard market. Their definition of a hard market is, you know, some sort of event that sucks an inordinate amount of capital out of the marketplace that can't be readily replaced. To them, that's a hard market. To an agent or to a broker or to somebody in my business, or more importantly, to a consumer, We see a hard market as it's harder and harder to find capacity, and it's harder and harder to afford it. So we do look at it a little bit different. What we have seen, I would say, on a national scale, is we haven't seen it going backwards, but we're seeing it start to level off, if not moderate. So we're seeing fewer and fewer increases. We're seeing less and less the need to get price in certain parts of the country where we have been before. But I do think in parts of the Midwest, parts of the West Coast, you're going to see those folks are going to kind of learn what we learned in Florida a few years ago. You know, you're going to see mitigating circumstances on your policy. You're going to see percentage deductibles for hail, for flood, the things that we see in Florida around wind all the time that we're used to. Our markets kind of absorb that. I think you're going to see those terms and conditions kind of transition across the United States where folks are dealing with tornadoes and hail and those things that seem to be a little bit more frequent right now. I think it's a cyclical thing. It's kind of like the whole industry panicked back in 04 and 05 when we had four named storms in 04. We had Charley, Francis, Ivan, and Jean. And the very next year, you had Katrina, Wilma, and Rita. And everybody thought from now on, we're going to have six hurricanes a year. And then in 06, we had one named storm that made landfall. So I think what we're experiencing now is that same overreaction to these events. And I think if the industry can get through that, come up with a way to moderate some of what's occurring today, but not necessarily overreach the issue, I think we'll start to see some leveling of the playing field probably, you know, as early as the end of this year or into the beginning of next year.
Final question, Alan. As it's an incredible thing that these days there's five generations in the workforce right now, from the seniors, silent generation, boomers, millennials, or Gen X, sorry, millennials, and then Gen Z, the very large generation now in their 20s, you know, emerging professionals. It's a challenge for organizations of all kinds just to manage the culture, to you know, make the employer brand called insurance a better place, but also retain great talent. So what are some things you've learned over the years, you know, coming from the family situation you're in to something larger, having witnessed the layoffs you saw, as well as people moving, having been asked to move to another location, has been through some of that. But anything you've learned, and what advice can you give folks when it comes to managing culture?
That's a great question. And culture is a huge thing in our organization. It's something we're proud of. It's something we drive home with our people. You know, we're fortunate in that we have 168 employees, and 162 of them are located here in Jacksonville. So we all work out of one office, one location. Oddly enough, we have 162 people in a single story building. So there's no elevators, there's no stairwells. It's a big open space that everybody is collaborating in and working in together. We do have somebody in every one of those population or demographic cohorts you talk about. We got 19-year-old kids up to people in their late 60s in our organization. And really what we found is, one, we are transparent to a fault with our folks. So we're very, very open about how we run the business, how we set the goals for the business, how we succeed as a business. We share premium data on a daily basis with all of our folks. They know exactly where we are relative to plan or where we're trying to get as an organization. We share the process of how we get to those numbers. We seek collaboration in that planning process. So we try to give everybody, I'm going to say we try to give everybody a little bit of a voice in how we run our business. And, you know, someone who's 59 years old has a different outlook over the next 5 years than someone who's 22 years old. And that's something that's a little bit unique. But what we found is if you can find a common ground with your people, so you can find the right people, put them in the right situation, and get them in the right job, they're going to thrive. And that's going to really depend on their personality, who they're working with's personality. But what we've discovered, if you kind of let people figure it out and you're still providing this general pathway to where we're all trying to get, it works pretty well. And the other thing we've done is we've made an emphasis on finding people with a like skill set. And in our business, that skill set for us is not insurance, believe it or not. It's strong people skills, strong communication skills, and phenomenal customer service skills. And what we've determined, if we can find that person and put them in a group with other people that have that same skill set, we can teach each other insurance. And that's the easy part of what we do. It's how you treat the customer. It's how you do the follow-up. It's how you treat your peers that really creates your culture that makes people want to stay. We have an average tenure here of over 9 years. And I will tell you, of the 160 people, if you look at that nine-year number, we've hired over 65 people in the last 20 months. So we got some long-term folks here. I had mentioned earlier, I've been here 31 years. The first person I ever hired 30 years ago was still an employee here at U.S. Secure. So I think we value our people a lot, and you kind of got to come to a common ground sometimes. You know, it's not as easy as it was 20 years ago, I'll tell you that. The newer generations are a little more challenging. But if I think back to the way I behaved when I was 22 years old, I'm sure my boss at the time would tell me I was a little more challenging too. So I just think it's a little different.
Yeah. That's great stuff, Alan. Thank you for sharing that. And we're out of time, but I wish you good luck with the business. Really an incredible story. And for me, it talks about the opportunities that we have in the insurance industry. So thanks so much for being with us, Alan. Good luck to you. Let's stay in touch.
Great. Thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
Yes, sir.
This has been On Point with Peter Van Artrijk, a podcast presentation of Wells Media Group.